Interviews with guests here on Law & Disorder Radio and available for purchase at OR Books. Well, Chris Hedges, a warm welcome to Law & Disorder Radio.
Thank you.
Chris, before we get into the matter of the state of governance in the United States today, we'd like to learn your thoughts on two aspects of the current situation in Palestine. First, what is the status of the so-called ceasefire that's supposed to be in effect? And has Trump's new Board of Peace been providing any security in Gaza?
Well, the whole thing was a scam or a kind of sham peace plan from the beginning. I was stunned, as many people were, when the Security Council approved it with the abstention, of course, of Russia and China. It is a complete violation of international law in terms of never even bringing up the possibility of Palestinian sovereignty. Israel is allowed to determine the conditions by which supposedly phases will be developed, and the big one being, of course, disarming Hamas, which Hamas says it won't do. So it's not to be taken seriously. It's a kind of subterfuge or a cover to ratchet down the genocide, to carry out the genocide in slow motion.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WSJ.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The United States and its partners have launched Operation Epic Fury, one of the largest, most complex, most overwhelming military offensives the world has ever seen. Nobody's seen anything like it.
Conflict spreading across the Middle East after the U.S. and Israel launched an unprovoked war on Iran and assassinated Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. At least 550 people have been killed in Iran since Saturday. President Trump says the war could continue for weeks. Iran's retaliated by striking Israel as well as U.S. allies across the Middle East. Israel's mobilized 100,000 reservists as it threatens to reinvade Lebanon. Israeli strikes on Lebanon have already killed at least 31 people. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for peace in the region.
Military action carries the risk of igniting a chain of events that no one can control in the most volatile region of the world. Let me be clear, there is no viable alternative to the peaceful settlement of international disputes. Lasting peace can only be achieved through peaceful means, including genuine dialogue and negotiations.
We'll speak to two Iranian-American professors, one who was on death row in Iran for years. We'll get a report from Israel and look at how the U.S.-Israeli attack violates international law. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Iranian Red Crescent Society says more than 550 people have been killed since the U.S. and Israel launched a full-scale military assault on Iran early Saturday. The unprovoked attack prompted Iran to launch missiles across the Middle East, targeting Israel and Gulf Arab nations. The joint U.S. and Israeli war on Iran began with a daytime assault on high-security compound of Ali Khamenei, Iran's 86-year-old supreme leader. He was killed in the attack, along with his daughter and grandchild, and with Iran's defense minister, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the chief of staff of Iran's armed forces, senior intelligence officials, and other Iranian leaders. Scores of civilians have also been killed in southern Iran. A missile struck a girls' elementary school in the city of Manab, killing at least 165 people. Nearly 100 others were injured. Video of the aftermath shows rescuers searching through twisted concrete and rubble strewn with textbooks and backpacks as screams are heard in the background.
As we entered the school, we saw the body of a teacher that had been cut in half. And as you can see, we are still clearing the debris, and even now, body parts are still coming out.
In another strike, 18 people, most of them children, were killed in Lamert in southern Iran when a missile struck residences and a gymnasium. About 100 people were wounded in that attack. In a video message, President Trump called for regime change and urged Iranians to take over their government. On Sunday, Trump confirmed reports that 3 U.S. service members have been killed, a toll that's since risen to 5. Trump said there would likely be more injuries and deaths ahead in an operation he said could last for weeks.
For almost 50 years, these wicked extremists have been attacking the United States while chanting the slogan, death to America or death to Israel or both. They are the world's number one state sponsor of terror. We are the world's greatest and most powerful nation, so we can do something about what they do.
President Trump launched the attacks without congressional approval. They came shortly after Omani mediators held a breakthrough in indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran and Geneva when Iran agreed to zero stockpiling of uranium as a guarantee that it would not pursue a nuclear weapon. Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi condemned the U.S. for abandoning diplomacy.
Contrary to Americans, that their record is very bad and very negative. You know, this is the second time that we negotiated with Americans and they decided to attack us right in the middle of negotiation.
In Israel, an Iranian ballistic missile struck a residential district of Beit Shemesh on Sunday, killing 9 people and wounding 27 others. Another strike killed a woman in Tel Aviv. Other Iranian missiles were intercepted by Israeli defenses, including one that crashed onto a street in Jerusalem, injuring several people. Iran also launched retaliatory strikes against all Gulf Arab nations that host U.S. military bases, with the exception of Oman, Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. All were struck. One person was killed in Abu Dhabi, another person killed in Kuwait, where a defense ministry official reported 3 U.S. F-15 fighter jets were mistakenly shot down by Kuwaiti air defenses. In Saudi Arabia, an oil refinery caught fire after it was struck by debris from an Iranian missile, closing a facility that processes over 500,000 barrels of crude oil a day. Shipping through the Strait of Hormuz has effectively come to a halt due to the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran. Oil prices have surged to a 52-week high, with many analysts predicting they could soon top $100 a barrel. Hundreds of thousands of travelers have been stranded as all flights through some of the world's busiest international airports have been grounded. Stock markets across Asia opened sharply lower on fears the attack on Iran will slow the global economy. Lebanon's health ministry says at least 31 people have been killed and nearly 150 wounded since Israel launched renewed airstrikes on Beirut's suburbs and other parts of Lebanon on Sunday. Tens of thousands of residents of southern and eastern Lebanon were seen fleeing their homes after Israel ordered people in nearly 50 villages to evacuate ahead of a planned bombing campaign. Israel's military says its renewed war on Lebanon comes in response to missiles and drones fired by Hezbollah in retaliation for the assassination of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. They were Hezbollah's first major violations of a ceasefire that took effect in November 2024. During that time, the United Nations peacekeeping force in Lebanon, known as UNIFIL, documented more than 15,000 ceasefire violations committed by Israel. Officials in the United Kingdom say an Iranian drone struck a British airbase in Cyprus overnight, causing limited damage and no casualties. Iran's attack came after British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said he'd agreed to the Pentagon's request to use British military bases for what Starmer called defensive strikes on Iranian missile sites. Separately, France said it was sending 2 warships to the Red Sea to join a European naval mission. Meanwhile, Germany's foreign minister denied reports that Berlin was seriously considering joining the war against Iran. In Spain, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez condemned the U.S.-Israeli strikes as a breach of international law.
Se puede estar contra un régimen odioso It is possible to be against a hateful regime, as Spanish society as a whole is against the Iranian regime, and at the same time be against an unjustified, dangerous military intervention that's outside international law. One must be against a war that was started without the authorization of the United States Congress or the United Nations Security Council.
On Saturday, Russia and China requested an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council, where China's foreign minister called for an immediate ceasefire and the resumption of talks. Russia condemned the U.S.-Israeli attacks as another unprovoked act of armed aggression. Today, U.S. First Lady Melania Trump is presiding over a U.N. Security Council meeting titled Children, Technology, and Education in Conflict. It's the first time a spouse of a world leader has chaired such a session, and comes just days after U.S.-Israeli strikes killed scores of Iranian school children. The White House says top Trump administration officials will brief both chambers of Congress Tuesday about the U.S. strikes in Iran. President Trump launched the attacks without congressional authorization, which is required under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. On Saturday, Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna of California and Republican Congressmember Thomas Massie of Kentucky demanded swift action on a war powers resolution that would rein in Trump's attack unless Congress approves military action. This comes as top Democrats, including Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, are under fire from anti-war groups who note they oppose Trump's attack on Iran on procedural grounds rather than opposition to war. A Reuters Ipsos poll conducted over the weekend found only 1 in 4 U.S. residents approves the U.S. strikes on Iran. In Pakistan, at least 24 people were killed Sunday as angry protests over the U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran were met with violence. In Karachi, security guards at the U.S. consulate fired on demonstrators who breached the outer wall, killing 10 people. At least 14 were killed in northern Pakistan, where demonstrators vandalized several buildings and set fire to United Nations regional offices. Meanwhile, Pakistan escalated its war in Afghanistan. Afghanistan's Taliban over the weekend with an attempted strike on Bagram Air Base, the former U.S. military base north of Kabul. Hundreds of soldiers and scores of civilians have been killed in cross-border fighting since Pakistan announced a state of open war with Afghanistan last week. In Texas, at least 2 people were killed and 14 wounded early Sunday during a mass shooting at a bar in a busy nightlife district in Austin. This marked the 58th mass shooting in the United States so far this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. The FBI is investigating the shooting as a possible act of terrorism after the suspect reportedly wore a shirt with an Iranian flag design and a hoodie with the words "Property of Allah" printed on it. The suspect was identified as 53-year-old Ndiaga Diagne, a naturalized U.S. citizen from Senegal. He was fatally shot by police. Trump's Republican allies have manipulated the shooting to perpetuate anti-immigrant hate speech and policies, but have again refused to call for stricter gun reform laws. At least the identities of the victims have not been made public. At least 3 of those hospitalized were in critical condition. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel has condemned the U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran, saying, quote, "The execrable act constitutes an unscrupulous violation of all norms of international law and human dignity." His remarks came as President Trump continued his threats against Cuba. On Friday, Trump said the United States may launch a so-called friendly takeover of the island.
They're in a big deal of trouble, as you know. They have no money, they have no anything right now, but they're talking with us, and maybe we'll have a friendly takeover of Cuba.
Former President Bill Clinton denied having any knowledge of sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's crimes during a 6-hour closed-door deposition Friday in front of the House Oversight Committee. Clinton's sworn testimony marked the first time a former U.S. president has been compelled to testify before Congress. He's also the most high-profile figure to respond to questioning following the release of the Epstein files. This is part of Clinton's opening statement, which he shared on social media.
"I saw nothing and did nothing wrong. As someone who grew up in a home with domestic violence, not only would I not have flown on his plane if I had any inkling of what he was doing, I would have turned him in myself and led the call for justice for his crimes, not the sweetheart deal that he got.
Former President Clinton's testimony came one day after his wife, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, told the committee she didn't know Epstein. Bill Clinton flew on Epstein's private jet a number of times in the early 2000s. He also appears in a photo with Epstein and a woman whose identity was redacted sitting in a hot tub. Clinton adamantly denied knowing the woman in his congressional testimony. And a North Dakota judge has said he will order Greenpeace to pay damages estimated at $345 million, a move that could potentially bankrupt the environmental group. Last year, a jury sided with Energy Transfer, the corporation behind the Dakota Access Pipeline, a closely watched trial and lawsuit by the Texas-based pipeline company, which accused Greenpeace of orchestrating criminal behavior by training and providing funds to the indigenous-led protests at Standing Rock between 2016 and 17. Greenpeace argued the lawsuit was part of a conspicuous attempt by corporations to destroy the right to free speech. Last March, Democracy Now! Spoke to Deepa Padmanabha, senior legal advisor for Greenpeace USA.
What's really important to know is that, you know, this case is not just an obvious and blatant erasure of Indigenous leadership, of Indigenous resistance, but this case is also so much bigger than just Greenpeace. It is an attack on the broader movement and all of our First Amendment rights to free speech and peaceful protest.
Judge James Guyon previously cut the jury award nearly in half from more than $670 million to about $345 million. Greenpeace could appeal to the North Dakota Supreme Court. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. and Israeli war on Iran has entered its third day. According to the Iranian Red Crescent Society, more than 550 people have been killed in Iran since Saturday. The dead include Iran's 86-year-old Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, who was assassinated in an airstrike targeting his compound. A number of other top Iranian officials have been killed, including Iran's defense minister, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and the chief of staff of Iran's armed forces. Iran says an Israeli airstrike on a girls' elementary school in the city of Manab killed 165 people, mostly girls. Nearly 100 others were injured. Iran has retaliated by launching missiles targeting Israel as well as U.S. allies, including the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Cyprus, where an Iranian drone hit a British airbase. In Saudi Arabia, the country's largest oil refinery was forced to halt work after an Iranian drone attack. Israel's now threatening to reinvade Lebanon after Israel and Hezbollah exchanged rocket fire on Sunday. At least 31 people have been killed in Lebanon. Israeli authorities say 10 people have died in Israel since Iran began launching retaliatory strikes. President Trump launched the attack on Iran without congressional approval or the backing of the UN Security Council. In a video message Sunday, Trump again pushed for regime change in Iran.
I once again urge the Revolutionary Guard, the Iranian military, police, to lay down your arms and receive full immunity or face certain death. It will be certain death. Won't be pretty. I call upon all Iranian patriots who yearn for freedom to seize this moment, to be brave, be bold, be heroic, and take back your country. America is with you. I made a promise to you, and I fulfilled that promise. The rest will be up to you, but we'll be there to help.
During his remarks, President Trump also confirmed 3 U.S. soldiers have been killed, and he said there would likely be more. U.S. Central Command announced today that a 4th U.S. service member has been killed. Earlier today, 3 U.S. fighter jets were shot down over Kuwait in what CENTCOM has described as a, quote, apparent friendly fire incident, unquote. All 6 air crew ejected safely. The U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran Saturday came a day after the U.S. and Iran held indirect negotiations in Amman.
Following the talks, Oman's foreign minister said, quote, a peace deal is within our reach. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi spoke to Al Jazeera Sunday.
Well, Iran has been always open to diplomacy. And I think we have a very good record of that. Contrary to Americans, that their record is very bad and very negative. You know, this is the second time that we negotiated with Americans and they decided to attack us right in the middle of negotiation. Well, if their goal is change the regime, that is a mission impossible. The demise of the leader doesn't mean that, regime change or the change of the political system in Iran. No, we have a very well-established political system. We have a very rich constitution. And based on that, state institutions are in place. They are doing their job, their function.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Philadelphia, Golnar Nikpur is Associate Professor of Modern Iranian History at Dartmouth College, author of The Incarcerated Modern, Prisons and Public Life in Iran. And here in New York, Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi is a fellow at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the CUNY Graduate Center. He was previously professor and chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. The author of several books, including Islam and Dissent in Post-Revolutionary Iran, a memoir about his years on death row in Evin prison called Remembering Akbar, Inside the Iranian Revolution, and his latest book just out this year, The Long War on Iran, New Events, Old Questions. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Ghamari, let's begin with you. You were on death row in the Evin prison in Iran for, more than 3 years? You are now observing what has taken place this weekend. There was a big piece on you in Haaretz in Israel a few days ago that talked about your warning about taking out Khamenei and this possible strike that we're seeing today. Mm-hmm. Respond to what has taken place over the weekend.
This was, first of all, thank you for having me here. I think one of the most important lessons that we are learning here is that these attacks are causing much suffering for Iranian people, and it's destroying the space in which Iranians were struggling for social justice and civil liberties. This is exactly the opposite of what Iranians wished, and this destruction is causing tremendous harm to Iranian people.
As we're speaking, Defense Secretary Hegseth is holding a press conference at the Pentagon. He and the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane. American forces are hitting Iran, Hegseth said, surgically, overwhelmingly, and unapologetically. And then he went on to attack the media. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the significance? Well, the opening shots were against a girls' school in southern Iran. But now, between Israel and the U.S., hundreds of attacks on Tehran and other places in Iran.
Yes, the first wave of attacks happened at the office of the Supreme Leader, which caused him and the top echelon of Iranian military and defense apparatus to die. And I think that was a moment that Ayatollah Khamenei, who decided to remain in his office and remain defiant to American threats, and it was very clear that he cared about his own legacy rather than trying to run away or hide in any bunker. Many of his advisors told him that it's not safe Kiev to be in his office. And the story that I've been reading in Iranian press is that he refused to leave his office, and he said that if 90 million of Iranians have shelters to go to, I will go to shelter after them. But he remained in his office and became a martyr for his revolution.
Which is very interesting. We were talking on Saturday in a special broadcast we did with your colleague, Professor Ervan Abrahamian, who said this is an 86-year-old man who's dying of cancer, and now he has been martyred.
That's right. That's right. And he always remained defiant. I mean, people who believe in his mission, believe in his ideas, now are celebrating the fact that, that he remained up to the last moment of his life, remained defiant, and he wanted to follow the path of Yahya Sinwar of Hamas, and that kind of legacy is very, very important for him and his followers. And we saw that hundreds of thousands of people in Tehran and cities around the country and in the region poured into the streets and mourning his death.
So you've been imprisoned at the notorious Evin prison on death row. This was in the 1980s. And yet you warn against the toppling of this regime. Mm-hmm. Why?
Because I think that for in the past 40 years or so, there were so many important events happening inside Iranian society. Iranian society, a decade after decade, showed that, that they are capable of transforming their own society. Issues of social justice remained very prominent in Iranian society. Iranian women were very, very active in changing the conditions of their own life inside the country. And Iranian labor movement was very strong. Iranian students always were very strong. And I thought that at this moment, toppling the government without having a clear alternative only would damage those struggles that people have struggled to maintain throughout these past 40 years would diminish. And I'm very pessimistic about the possibility of a regime change in Iran without having a clear idea of what is going to replace it.
Let's go to Professor Golnar Nikpour of Dartmouth. If you can respond to what has taken place over this weekend, what is happening in Iran right now that you are hearing. You're the author of The Incarcerated Modern, Prisons and Public Life in Iran, and who the leadership possibly is. President Trump, soon after the hundreds of attacks were taking place on Iran, and then Iran retaliating throughout the Gulf and against Israel as well, President Trump said to The Atlantic magazine that he was willing to talk again.
Yes, first of all, thank you so much for having me, Amy. I appreciate it a great deal. The situation in Iran, as you've noted, is quite dire right now. There have been innumerable military attacks across the country, over 550 reported killed so far. As mentioned, a great deal of the upper echelon of the leadership has been wiped out, including now former Supreme Leader having been killed, Ali Khamenei. A three-person leadership council has been created to manage the day-to-day affairs of the state as it decides on a new leader, and that includes current president Masoud Pezeshkian, important conservative cleric Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, and Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Ejayi, who is chief justice of the country. It's also quite clear that Ali Larijani has been incredibly important in managing the day-to-day affairs of the country. So the leadership structure that remains is trying to promote an idea of stability, promote the idea that there is an internal systematic effort to replace those who have been already killed with the next in line, and to sort of stabilize the system both actually and in its presentation. So that's the situation that we're in internally in the country. But it's quite a devastating attack on the infrastructure of the country, both in terms of the state infrastructure and civilian infrastructure. We've already gotten reports of hospitals being hit. And as you mentioned, the sort of opening salvo and the most devastating attack launched so far was against a girls' school in southern Iran in Minab, where well over 100 people have been killed, mostly children. So yes, you know, I very much agree with Professor Qamari Tabrizi that this is a situation that creates a kind of code red internally in the country, wherein we're not seeing something like, you know, protests on the streets because people are concerned with avoiding the sure death of bombs falling. And I had reports yesterday from some contacts in Iran that people are using old bunkers or old facilities that they had used during the Iran-Iraq war to shelter in Tehran from the bombardment. But everyone is as far as I can tell, using makeshift sort of efforts to stay out of harm's way. Of course, the internet has been cut by the Iranian government again, which means that there is a trickle rather than a flood of information, and that there is a great deal of misinformation that people are being subjected to from malign actors on the internet. So one of the things that we have been trying to do is get a sense of what is really happening in the country. And I'll conclude by just saying that one of my own concerns, and I'm sure that this is something that Behruz would echo as well, having had this experience himself in the 1980s, but as a scholar of prisons and prisoners, I'm quite worried about what the situation is inside of Iran's prisons. There were some reports from political prisoners in the country saying that there was limited access to food. This is a captive population, so if bombs are falling, they are captive to where they are, and they're also going to be sort of privy to whatever the authorities in Iran choose to do as well, including any sort of retaliation that they may choose to undertake. So that's something I'm keeping my eye on right now. There hasn't been any specific news out of prisons beyond some worry about food being limited, but there is a concern about this population.
I wanted to ask Professor Behruz Ghamari about this comment of the reporter Jonathan Carl, who said, President Trump told me tonight the U.S. had identified possible candidates to take over Iran, but they were killed in the initial attack. Trump told me, Jonathan Carl said, the attack was so successful, it knocked out most of the candidates. It's not going to be anybody we were thinking of because they're all dead. Second or third place is dead, he said. So I wanted to go through who some of the possible candidates are, and maybe you could elaborate. You've got Mojtaba Khamenei, who is the son of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who is killed. You've got Alireza Arafi, director of Iran's religious seminaries, Mohammad Mahdi Mirbagheri, ultra-hardline cleric, and among others. Also, Hassan Khamenei, the grandson of Ayatollah Khomeini, who yes. died before Khamenei.
Yes. I don't think that the Iranian state is in any rush to appoint a successor to Ayatollah Khamenei at this point. They have a council.
Because they're concerned he would be killed.
Yes, and also it would be a rushed decision, and that decision has to be made by the assembly of experts, and they have to find time for a meeting of the Assembly of Experts to appoint the successor of Ayatollah Khamenei. And I think that the council that my colleague Gulnar just mentioned is appointed there to take care of the leadership issues at this point. And so far they are able to maintain a succession of leadership and at the very highest levels. And I don't believe that any of these candidates that you named are going to be one of those candidates that they are going to replace Ayatollah Khamenei. The important person that people talk about is the cleric from the Supreme Court, the Guardians Council, Ayatollah Arafi, who is a religious leader, not much of a political actor, but very respected in the seminaries. So at this point, people are mostly talking about him. But that's yet to be seen, that how this transfer of power would happen. But I do not think that they are in a rush to appoint a successor to Ayatollah Khamenei, because the structure of leadership is in place, and they were expecting this for a long time, and they are going to take their time before announcing any successor to Khamenei. Whether or not the Trump administration is in conversation with people inside Iranian political power, this sort of Venezuela model, we don't know. They're all speculation whether or not they're talking about to people about the possible successor who would be friendlier to American interests in the region. But at this point, these are all the speculations.
What about the president, the current Iranian president, Pezeshkian, who's believed to be alive?
Yes, but he is not going to be appointed as the supreme leader. The supreme leader needs to be coming from the ranks of the clergy. So he is not going to be appointed in that position. The person who is very important at this point, as Gulnar mentioned, is Ali Larijani, who is the head of the National Security Council. And he's been very, very active, and he's pretty much in charge of the affairs at this point, with consultation with the Council of Leadership that is in place right now.
And what about Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah, known for his brutal rule through his secret police, the Savak?
Reza Pahlavi basically is a Israeli-American project, and in recent months, he's been gaining support inside.
Where is he?
He is in the U.S. He lives in Maryland, but he's traveling, trying to gain support from American politicians and the U.S. Congress and some Europeans. He has a significant support among Iranian diaspora. But this has been a project in the making for many years, and millions and millions of dollars have been poured into making Reza Pahlavi an alternative to the Islamic Republic. Whether or not he can emerge as the real alternative, we don't know. But I doubt it.
Professor Gulnar Nitpour, you wrote a piece for Jacobin last year, The Fail Son and the Flag. Explain.
Yes, in that piece, I essentially argued, as Behruz just did so ably, that Reza Pahlavi is fundamentally an Israeli-American project, as he just said. He has been the sort of hope of the neo-monarchist movement for many years, and indeed decades, but has never been able to build organizational support, institutional support within Iran. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have supporters, of course. Largely in the diaspora, he's an important political figure in the diaspora, maybe the important political figure, and presumably some supporters in the country as well. But no institutional kind of entrenchment, right? No no organization or political party or council that can be imagined as having state-like functions and stepping in to fill a power vacuum. To bring Reza Pahlavi, who himself in an interview not very long ago said that he can't even imagine moving back to Iran full time because his life is in the United States. He said this on a right-wing podcast in the U.S. a couple of years ago. And this is a figure that just does not have connections, organic connections to political movements in the country. So for him to emerge either as a transitional leader, which is what he says that he wants to be, or as a long-term leader, would need, in my view, significant military investment on the part of outside powers to prop up his rule. Boots on the ground, because there is a strong military apparatus and institutional apparatus in Iran of the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, and Reza Pahlavi doesn't have a comparable institutional support in the country. So to imagine bringing him to power would need a great deal of military support. This is what he has been essentially on the back scene advocating for, but has, to my knowledge, not managed to quite convince the Trump administration.
Professor Behrouz Ghamari, let me ask you a question because we begin to wrap up about Iran retaliating by sending drones to Israel, by going after the Gulf states one after another, and the significance of this, where you'd think they would want not to alienate these Gulf states, but now if you can explain the attacks on Saudi Arabia, on UAE, on Qatar, on Bahrain, now apparently on Cyprus, you know, there's a British base on Cyprus.
Right. Iran is primarily targeting the U.S. bases in these countries, and many of these missiles are targeting Iran from the Saudi soil, from the UAE, from Kuwait, and Iran has forewarned them that they should not allow the U.S. to launch its attack from their soil, and it's the case that obviously when they start attacking, there are damages that happens outside American bases. But primarily that's the objective, to attack American bases in these countries. And they also want to expand the war. And Ayatollah Khamenei last week mentioned that if there is an attack on Iran, it's going to be a regional war. And this regional war, they want to make sure that they create an expansive war that is felt by the entire region and globally, because then they are going to disrupt the flow of oil. They are going to show Europeans primarily that they cannot sit on the sidelines without taking a position against this illegal act of aggression.
We just got news that the wife of the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, has also succumbed to her injuries. She has died. We know that also killed in that attack, aside from the close to 50 commanders, was Khamenei's daughter and also grandchild. Your final thoughts. Again, you're a professor here in the United States now, but you were imprisoned at Evin prison. You were on death row. What's going to happen now, and why you feel so strongly that you are though you are a deep critic of this regime, that this war on Iran is wrong?
Because I think, you know, I can't find any reason to celebrate the assassination of the Iranian supreme leader, because I think it's part of a package. It's a package, because the assassination of the Iranian supreme leader is also part of the killing of Iranian school children. It's also part of the killing of Iranian innocent people. It's also part of the attack attack on Iranian hospitals. And these are not separate issues. And I think that that for that very reason, I don't think there is any reason to celebrate the demise of Iranian leader, because it's happening in the hands of what I call the king of genocide, and someone in the U.S. who's so deeply in trouble with the American legal system, with the Epstein files, and so for as many people say that this is Epstein war, and I think that we should not be sort of fooled to think that this is in any shape or form is done on behalf of Iranian people. This is done on behalf of American and primarily on behalf of Israeli interest. And I think Americans should ask themselves that why exactly are we attacking Iran without any kind of provocation? This is a war that is not in the interest of the United States, and is only fulfills and realizes the desires of a regime in Israel that is promoting forever wars in the region.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi, fellow at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the CUNY Graduate Center. His latest book, The Long War in Iran, New Events, Old Questions. He's previously professor and chair of the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton, where he directed the Center for Iran and Persian Gulf Studies, was imprisoned at Evin Prison in the 1980s, on death row there. And Golnar Nikpur, associate professor of modern Iranian history at Dartmouth College, author of The Incarcerated Modern Prisons and Public Life in Iran. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Tel Aviv and also look at Europe and how it's responding right now to the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran. Stay with us.
Stand behind his drunken imp. Stand behind his light of love. Hear him yowl his bloody tongue. Hear him yellow blood and war. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in second chance? Do you believe in rapture, babe?
You Believe in Rapture by Thurston Moore, performing at Smith College in 2005. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman. As we continue to look at the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, Israel's mobilized 100,000 reservists as it threatens to reinvade Lebanon. Lebanon's health ministry says at least 31 people have been killed, nearly 150 wounded, since Israel launched renewed airstrikes in Beirut suburbs and other parts of Lebanon on Sunday. Tens of thousands of residents of southern and eastern Lebanon were seen fleeing their homes after Israel ordered people in nearly 50 villages to evacuate. Israel's military says its renewed war in Lebanon comes in response to missiles and drones fired by Hezbollah in retaliation for the assassination of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. They were Hezbollah's first major violations of a ceasefire that took effect in November 2024. During that time, the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon, known as UNIFIL, documented more than 15,000 ceasefire violations committed by Israel. Israeli police say 9 people were killed after an Iranian missile attack on the central city of Beit Shemesh. Another strike killed a woman in Tel Aviv. This is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking Sunday.
We are in a campaign in which we are bringing the full force of the IDF, as never before, to ensure our existence and our future. But we are also bringing into this campaign the assistance of the United States, my friend, U.S. President Donald Trump, and the U.S. military. And this combination of forces enables us to do what I have long hoped to do for 40 years, to strike the terror regime decisively. That is what I promised, and that is what we will do.
We're joined right now by Uri Goldberg, Israeli political analyst, scholar in Tel Aviv, written extensively on Iran, Israel, and the relationship between religion and politics in the Middle East. Uri, thanks so much for being with us again. You were there for our special broadcast on Saturday. Can you talk about the response on the ground right now in Israel to the Israeli-U.S. attack on Iran and then the response by Iran?
Well, as far as the Israeli general population goes, there is a broad embrace of this attack. In fact, the consensus, which so far during the protests against the Netanyahu government has been shushed and actively repressed, is now surfacing with full strength. That is the alliance between the Israeli liberals and the Israeli right, the settlers, the religious elements in the government. They all seem to agree broadly and deeply that this war is inevitable, that it must be carried out right now, and that it has and Israel has absolutely no choice. And of course, that this war will only end with a real toppling of the regime in Tehran, a campaign that can and should last as long as it takes, which is something our prime minister has said repeatedly over the last few days. The population is resigned to this war. It supports it. It doesn't appear to be jubilant. Nobody's accepting Netanyahu's boasts like they did after the IDF mobilized and invaded Gaza following the events of October 2023. But there's a sense that this has to be done, and we're doing what has to be done.
And what about the call for 100,000 Israeli reservists for the possible reinvasion of Lebanon?
Well, the Israeli government mobilizes reservists with great ease, certainly now when the entire country is at a shutdown. It might have been a little more difficult had the country been in full working mode, but it most certainly is not. Most Israelis are shuttling between shelters and taking care of kids who are home from school, as the educational system is not working either. Mobilizing 100,000 reservists, as I said, is not that difficult. Will Israel invade Lebanon? Particularly when we hear that the Lebanese prime minister has officially declared that the government of Lebanon forbids Hezbollah from operating in any sort of military capacity from Lebanese territory. I doubt very much that we will see another invasion of Lebanon. Israel so far seems quite pleased to be attacking, bombing, killing, and destroying from the air, just as is the case with the United States in Iran.
How many times have you been sent into shelter, Uri? On Saturday, I think it was, we're up to 12 by the time we spoke at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes, and then I think we got to about 20, but it hasn't really improved. The frequency has somewhat lessened, but we can get one sheltering order in place, then have it rescinded after 10 minutes, and then after 2 minutes, have it on again. Classically, overcompensation for the beginning of the Gaza quote-unquote war. When the IDF and the Israeli state were caught completely unprepared. Now the powers that be here seem to have reached a decision that it's better to send the entire country into shelters than to have even one unnecessary casualty.
Can you talk about the negotiations that were happening in Geneva around Iran's nuclear program, this happening in the midst of them as they were planning to continue this week? This is something that you've looked at continually.
I'm not going to go off on a speculative tangent. I cannot corroborate this completely or positively. But to the best of my understanding, this was not the result of an operation meant to misdirect Iranian attention or meant to secure reasons for a preventive attack. If it was, then this isn't a preventive attack. If this has been planned for months and years, then there's no doubt that there's nothing preventive or legal about it. What I gather is that there was some convergence of intelligence. There was a realization that Iran's senior leadership was going to meet in a somewhat unprecedented fashion in Tehran. This is the sort of tactical intelligence at which Israel excels. Israelis brought this to the attention of the United States. The forces were already in place. because, again, moving forces is easier than sending them into an actual war. Same case for the United States as it is for Israel. So the forces were already in place, and all that was needed was the spark of that particular meeting where Israel and the United States believed that they could assassinate the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic. They succeeded in everything that has happened since, pretty much, ever since the opening shock and awe enhanced, as it were, has, I think, been learning and working in motion. Targets have been identified for months and years. There's no doubt that's the case. But any kind of coherent, consequent logic that would be apparent in such a program, any kind of final goal, any kind of vision as to what regime change might actually include, that does not seem to be a part of either the Israeli or the American working plan in Iran at the moment. And in fact, President Trump could declare victory whenever he so chooses. He's already assassinated the supreme leader. Israel could declare victory whenever it so chooses, but Israel over the past 2.5 years has become exceedingly greedy. It doesn't want to commit itself to anything. It actually, I think, what Israel is fighting for is the right to be able to go off on such attacks whenever it wants, wherever it wants, for as long as it wants. So don't expect Israel to come to a political realization that this might end. Again, the population supports Prime Minister Netanyahu. The opposition has officially disbanded itself and declared that there were no coalition or opposition now, just the United People of Israel. So don't look to Israel for any kind of political statement.
Ori Goldberg, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli political analyst and scholar in Tel Aviv. When we come back, we go to war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody. Stay with us.
In the Haggadi forsaken, got no reason to cry. You got to chew the angels falling from on high, waiting for no answer. Baking woeful pie, pie of eyesight, pie blue black. Oh, that pie, the pie of pie and pie. In the hog of the forsaken, he will leave you one more chance.
Folk musician Michael Hurley, Hog of the Forsaken. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United States and Israel are facing global condemnation for launching unilateral attacks on Iran without seeking approval of the UN Security Council. We go now to France, where we're joined by Reed Brody, longtime war crimes prosecutor, member of the International Commission of Jurists, author of To Catch a Dictator. Reed, if you can respond to what has taken place, the U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran, and then Iran retaliating by sending missiles and drones throughout the Gulf and against Israel.
Sure, Amy. I mean, look, whatever you think of the theocratic dictatorship in Iran, these attacks by the U.S. and Israel are a clear violation of the foundational principle of the post-war legal order, which is the non-use of force. So the U.N. Charter is not ambiguous. Article 2, Section 4 prohibits the use of force against the territorial integrity or the political independence of any state. And there are only two exceptions. One, if the Security Council authorizes it, which obviously nobody sought here, or self-defense. And that means self-defense in response to an actual or an imminent armed attack. And here there was no, it's obvious, there was no such imminent attack. President Trump even said last year that he had obliterated Iran's nuclear capacity. As you've reported, both sides had just concluded the most intensive round of nuclear talks. So there was no, you know, immediate threat here. And so President Trump has presumptively committed the crime, the international crime of aggression, as he did in Venezuela, and just as Vladimir Putin did in Ukraine. And at the Nuremberg trials, the supreme international crime was considered to be aggression, crimes against peace. It's also important to remember that under U.S. law, as you've put it, the Constitution gives Congress, not the president, the power to declare war. And this is not some quaint historical debate. The framers were very cognizant that executives, that kings start war, and that war is the most consequential decision that a nation can take. And it should not be left to a single person's judgment. The framers had seen the alternative, the royal prerogative of bringing a war. And that was precisely the kind of tyranny they wanted to avoid, that one person on a whim or for whatever. I mean, obviously, they had not, I don't think the founders ever imagined that they would have a president who would launch a war because he was dropping in the polls, or because he wanted to divert from the Epstein files, or because he didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize. But, you know, it is a foundational principle here that the president cannot just decide to go to war. He can do it in an emergency. And that's why the Constitution says doesn't say that only the Congress can make war, because they allow the president in the case of an emergency. But not to declare war and keep a war going.
We have 10 seconds. President Trump now told The Atlantic magazine they want to talk, and I've agreed to talk, so I'll be talking to them. As the U.S. and Israel strikes Iran hundreds of times, and apparently the Pentagon, the president is saying this will go on for weeks.
Well, you know, I mean, we're shifting. I mean, this shows that there was no plan here. The whole reason, I mean, one of the main reasons to have this constitutional provision is so that a war can be deliberated, so you understand what a war is about. You go to the people, you go to the Congress,
deliberate,
and you decide as a nation there should be a war or there shouldn't be.
Reed Brody, war crimes prosecutor, member of the International Commission of Jurists. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.